Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. You know, we just finished recording this one about models, right? And using models and understanding assumptions and all kinds of good stuff. And it dawned on me that a lot of that discussion applies to standards, right? We got a question a couple of days ago, at least I did, a question about, is there a standard for me to get the right sample size to show that I have X amount of reliability in my product? No, was my short answer. But there is a lot of emphasis on standards in all kinds of different industries and all kinds of different disciplines. And I know you've been on standards bodies and helped write standards, and I know I have. When I think of what standards to recommend to somebody, I'm always exceedingly hesitant to do that.
Yeah, this is just a fascinating subject because there's a lot of emotion on this as well as practicality. There are some really good standards, and there's some outstanding ANSI standards. There's a number of good ISO standards. So much depends on the committee, what the scope is, what their objective is, because there's also a lot of standards that get misused. And so let's just take up one, for example. I remember I used to be friends with Patrick O'Connor, and I would bring him into GM. And GM at the time was going through their love affair with the ISO 9000 series. Mm-hmm. And every plant and every, you know, we were always talking about the importance of quality management systems. And of course, O'Connor, I say, of course, I know this.
I know this.
Yes, yeah. But not everybody else knows this. Just didn't like 9000 series at all. And so I brought him, I remember bringing him into one of the management meetings at GM just to talk about reliability. And somebody brought up 9000, and Patrick turned to him and just gave him his speech on how useless the time is to spend on this series when you should be spending your time on improving your products. And it was like really eye-opening to a lot of those people. But just to summarize my thought there is here's what's wrong. There's a lot of things right about some standards. Here's what's wrong. It doesn't make any sense to me to spend your time documenting a process that's a wrong process.
Well, yeah, there's that. There's a lot of that. But it might be the right process in one particular niche. And then I think that the error of the standard writer then is not making that absolutely abundantly clear. This is when to use this and under what circumstances. They just write a standard saying, add all the failure rates and you're good. No. That's right. It's not a universal.
Right. Yeah. So the scope, it's important because reliability engineers are not going to change the whole subject of standards overnight. And so their companies will be drawing upon their customers require and mandate. So you have to learn how to navigate what's good and what's not good about standards and how to work within that framework. And so one thing you're bringing up, Fred, is you have to know the limitations of the standard, even if the standard committee didn't make it clear. You need to learn what are the limitations.
Yeah. And you see it with components in particular, electronics components, as they'll say, well, we use these 15 different standards and we tested, 77 samples from three different batches and had no failures. Therefore, it's good. It's good for what? Because when you open up the standards, it basically tells you how to run the test, but it doesn't tell you what material set or what technology or what material processing or anything. It just says, put it in an 85 degrees C oven for, you know, 85 RH for 1,000 hours. And if you get, if nothing fails in it, it doesn't really even say how to know if it's failed or not. What are you looking for? And the ones that really bother me is you put it in an oven, you don't even turn them on. You don't even power the units. You don't even monitor them. What good is this?
Well, so let's state this real clearly for people that are listening. And as always, we'd love to hear from people about this. But just from my point of view, one of the big problems is people that think the standard is the body of knowledge.
Right.
Because the standard is not the body of knowledge. The standard is a standard.
Yeah.
It's got information about how to use something, but it is not the body of knowledge itself. And so it's very important for people to understand the body of knowledge that surrounds the standard, so you can think with the material. And then standards can make sense, because what they do is they find points of agreement between companies and maybe between continents that we're going to standardize the approach, but they don't supplant the body of knowledge that's underneath it.
No. And I also know from experience that these, when you're on a committee like this, it's often what can we agree on, and that becomes the standard. And it's like, it's not necessarily based in science. There's not a lot of research or studies. These are generally written by a group of volunteers that may or may not have a vested interest in it having a particular nuance to it. And this is beyond just reliability work. The housing and construction industry has a series of standards, and they all get involved with standards writing because they don't want to be left out of the market because their competitor put a feature in that their product can't meet. I'd like to think the reliability folks aren't that nefarious, but I've seen it. I also see just that a lot of people with good intentions are just hamstrung by the business concerns and by the lack of funding to do the testing. Now, there are some standard bodies out there, or consortiums, I should say, that, you know, they have a relatively high fee structure, but it allows them to get a bunch of grad students to go run the test. I'm thinking of CALS and Semitech and some of these other ones. Behind their work is a bunch of research in fundamental science and experimentation to show that this model fits. And it's very clear when and where it doesn't fit. The issue I have with, and like ANSI standards, I love them because if you want to know how to test the hardness of a metal, there's a standard for that, and it tells you by step how to do it. And you don't have to go recreate that process. And it's used as a communication vehicle between organizations to say, well, if I measure this hardness according to this standard, they could replicate it. When it comes to doing life testing, if I run a high temperature over life test and you run a high temperature over life test and we have different products, it's the interpretation of those results is completely different. It doesn't mean that it passed. It just means that it survived the test. It doesn't tell you if it's going to last a year or 10 years or 100 years or what failure mechanism was even excited. It doesn't tell you any of that stuff.
No, it doesn't.
I think you mentioned earlier, there's hundreds and hundreds of standards out there. And there's some are good, thousands, and some are better than the others. So how do you assess a standard? Or when would you go use the standard? How do you know when it's appropriate?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, you have to, this is very obvious, but you have to get a copy of it, and some of them are not cheap. And because you can't get copies of thousands and thousands. But let's say, I'll say XYZ standard, your company is using, you need to read it, understand what the science is behind it. So I study a standard. I don't just automatically assume it's right. I understand what the standard is saying to do. Then I compare it to my own knowledge. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have a knowledge in a certain area, I'll go get some knowledge. Mm-hmm. But what I don't want to be as an engineer, as a professional, I don't want to be in the position of just automatically assuming the standard is 100% correct.
Right.
Because sometimes they're not. And so you have to put your own body of knowledge, your own integrity higher. And of course, I'm preaching to the choir here, Fred, higher than the standard itself, and evaluate from your own point of view the application of it in your company or on your project or in your group. And then it can make a lot of sense. Some standards I've used for years, and I'm on, like you said, I'm on standards committees. And so I always try to make the standard as applicable as possible when I'm on a standards committee. But if somebody else has said, use XYZ standard, I'm going to make my own evaluation from my own experience and get my own take on it, so to speak.
Yeah. And I agree with the understand the physics and chemistry, especially in the reliability style of testing that we do. Say the one I mentioned earlier, high temperature over life. I'm going to put it at high temperature. And high temperature accelerates a wide array of failure mechanisms. But let's say the salient feature of this particular device you're trying to test is subject to thermal cycling, and you're putting it in something that has thermal cycling. The test results will give you, you'll spit out a number and say, I passed this standard. The marketing guys love that, right? All right, we passed XYZ standard, this one standard, and this standard. And they make, they don't often say it, but they'll imply that their product is good. I actually had a sales engineer from a company that will remain unnamed say, well, we passed rigorous, these 15 different standards and their rigorous criteria and blah, blah, blah. So therefore it must be good. And he says, well, is it good for 2 years or 2 minutes or 200 years?
Yeah. Yeah. What's the scope?
what's your good mean here? Is it good just for the duration of that test? Is that all? What's the relationship?
And another thing is, particularly regulatory standards, you have to meet them, but that does not mean necessarily that your part is good.
That's right. Oh, yeah. And yeah, definitely.
There's a necessary but not sufficient that context to it. So a lot of people think, well, I met the standard, therefore I'm good. Not necessarily.
And it's a trap. I've run into a couple of organizations that says, well, we're going into this market. We know it's going to get wet. So what's a standard we can use to see if we're good or not? Well, you got to think about it. Back up a little bit. And they learned the hard way that just because it survived a dunk test, you know, dunk tank, dropped in the water, pulled off, shake off the liquid, and it's still working, doesn't mean that corrosion is not going to happen after 5 or 6 days, which it did. And it caught them completely unawares when it got to market. And they said, but we used the standard. How come it didn't tell us what we wanted to do? Because it goes back to what you said, Carl, is understand the mechanisms, understand, do the engineering, do the science, and understand it. Now, when I look at a standard, especially when it's trying to say that if you do this, it must be good kind of approach, I just set it aside. It might have good technique for how to set up a chamber or how to monitor a device or doing whatever, but I'm not going to use it to say, oh, this means we got 10 years life. No, I want a standard that tells we apply these stresses for if you're experiencing or expect to see these specific failure mechanisms. And here's a model that converts the test results to your use conditions. That to me is beautiful. I can work with that all day long, right? But I almost never see it in a standard. They're too generic. They're too, they want to, here's the technique and you got to use your own wisdom to connect that to the right circumstances. And I think that's leaving standard buyers short.
Yeah, we can't bypass the necessary scientific rigor we have to apply in our engineering roles. So if you have a part that needs to meet a certain requirement, you need to go through the thought as to how you're going to ensure that it meets that requirement. And you may draw upon standards, but the standard doesn't replace the thought that you need to put into it. Yeah. And so it's knowing the context and usefulness of standards, where they fit. I think there's a great role because prior to standards, it was anarchy in a lot of areas. So to use the example of the hardness that you brought up, you don't need 15 different ways to test hardness, especially if you have a lot of different suppliers. It's very nice to have a standardized and agreed upon methodology. But that does not mean that you don't need to also know the science behind hardness.
Right. Right. Definite. One of the thoughts I had when you mentioned the regulatory standards, and I don't think it's a loophole, but I thought it was a nice trick, is, and you know, Carl, we're always scrambling to get samples in any development program, just enough samples to really move a program forward. And I looked at, and the regulatory guys came to the table and said, we need 15 samples, and it's a condition to doing business. So we don't have this little stamp on the side of it, we can't sell it in North America or Europe or wherever. And so they would get all these samples, and they would be doing, applying different stresses and different inspections and everything else. So I spent some time with them and looked through what they were doing and said, you know, If you're applying these stresses and we don't get any failures, or we do get failures or whatever, that's actually life data. We could use that. So how about we piggyback on top of your test, look over your shoulder, and in some cases said, well, let's monitor this part too. And they said, well, that's not necessary for the standard. I know, but now I can use it for reliability, and we get double duty out of that sample. And they were like, okay, but just don't get in our way. If you screw up our regulatory requirements, you know, that's a problem. We can't sell. And so it was a negotiation, but I was able to leverage a lot of the, not all of it, some of it. And they even agreed, the regulatory guys agreed, some of the things they had to do for some countries and some regulatory bodies was completely bonkers. It made no sense whatsoever, but it was a condition. And others made a lot of sense.
I think one of the misapplications is the one size fits all. Yeah. And that's where you need to know what the scope is, what the context, what the limitations are, because one size does not fit all.
Well, yeah. The other thing, Carl, I ran into, Carl, was that the standards bodies will often use a technique because they can, it's possible to be used, as opposed to being appropriate to use. And I ran into this with solar cells, is that in order to, it was difficult and expensive to do multiple suns. They called the unit was of radiation, basically was an equivalent of one sun for an hour or whatever duration it was, you know, like a high noon full blaze sun right on your device. And a way to accelerate it was to put two suns in the sky or three suns in the sky. Now, we don't quite have that technology, but we have lamps and ways to focus light and everything else that we can get up to 2,000 suns equivalent. It's difficult to do, and to do it knowingly. But the standards body decided that was, we can't do that. That's ridiculous. That's not, that nobody knows how to do that until we invented it. And what the standard body says, no, we're just going to change the current that we pump through it. So it's using the device in a reverse biased way. And it creates a fundamentally different failure mechanism. But they said, well, that's the closest we can get to testing this. So we're going to do it this way.
And game over.
Yeah. And like, this test is irrelevant. So we made the argument and showed people how to do this multiple sun test. And here's the model for it. And the fundamental change in the failure mechanism, which, by the way, happened to match the failure mechanisms we saw in the field. So
there you go.
Right where you started with it, Carl, was understand the science of it, understand that part of it.
And if our listeners would like to have us talk about any particular standards, or if you have experience on which ones are good, which ones are not so good, on your own experience, I think that'd be really great to hear about.
Oh yeah, definitely. When we signed off on the last episode, we had failure mechanisms and I'm drawing a blank. What the other series was? Failure mechanisms and models.
Yes, and models.
Models and failure mechanisms. And I don't know if it'd be as fascinating, but it sure is interwoven with what we do to be standards and, you know, bring up different ones,
particularly ones that relate to our reliability.
Yeah.
Community.
Yeah, definitely. It's a tougher topic, though, because a lot of that material is behind a paywall, and just to get a copy of it costs you a fortune. So,
yes, indeed, it does.
But I bet you between the two of us, Carl, we probably have, you know, dozens and dozens of recent standards that we could review. Would be an appropriate word for it. But yeah,
it'd be fun.
Yeah. So let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And what's your favorite standard, or what's your grudge with a standard. Hopefully we didn't come across too negative on standards. They do have a role. Or what do you think of doing a series on this? If we'd like to do reviews of standards, that would be an interesting other topic for us. As always, we love hearing from you. And many of the questions and comments we get end up being topics for shows. And so we always enjoy your input and having you join the conversation. So with that, Carl, I think we'll wrap this one up. Now we just created three whole new series for us. We're going to be in a couple thousand episodes before we finish this program off.
We've laid out our work.
There we go. Thanks so much, Carl.
Thanks, Fred.
We'll talk to you later. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.